Welcome to C-Suite Radio.
It's time for another edition of the Brett Allen Show.
It's go time, you and me.
Join us weekly for the latest pop culture interviews from your favorite TV shows, movies, comedians, and so much more.
Yeah, I'm not gonna lie to you, it felt good.
Plus, you never know who will drop by.
What happened here was a miracle.
Now, here is your host.
I said throw down, boy.
Welcome to the nice main event.
Brett Allen.
Our guest today on the show, I'm very excited, is comedian Caitlin Plufo. You've seen her on, of course, The Late Show, The Late Late Show, Comedy Central. She's a regular at the world famous Comedy Cellar and is open for some killer comedians. But she has her debut comedy album, Dirty Bird, releasing on March 8th. Congratulations. It's great to meet you and thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
So this is a big deal to have an album release. Where are you releasing it? Is it on 800 Pound or Blonde Medicine?
Blonde Medicine.
Okay, yes. Yeah. So we are friends with those folks. We've had plenty of their artists on the show. This is a big deal. How many years in the making is it for you to have this album come out?
Honestly, it's about 9 years in the making. I've been doing comedy for 10, and I finally pulled the trigger 9 years in. I was like, let's just get it all off, get it all out of here so I can try and write a new hour.
A big deal. So, I mean, 10 years, that's about the average, right, that most people wait. Sometimes it's sooner, but I think from all the comedians, your peers that I've spoken to, 10 years is about the mark where you're ready to put the material out and start working on new stuff. So how does it feel finally to be able to do that?
It feels it's terrifying and exciting. It's because you have to start over completely. And that is what is, oh God. It's like I did the album. I was so excited to finally be, I was sick of all my jokes. Oh, get rid of them. And then now a week later, I was like, oh my God, I have to write all new jokes. And it makes you think, have I ever written a joke in my life? How did I do that? Was it just manifested into my brain? I have no idea what my process is. It was so hard, to be honest, but we got there. I have a new hour. And it's coming along. It's not, you know, it's never where you want it to be right away, but it does exist. So that's good.
Yeah, I can imagine. I mean, until I started doing this and talking to comedians all the time in different levels, different places, like the common theme I have found is that when that special comes out, or say you've been touring this hour and then you record it and you get it put out and it's there for people, like it's a relief on one level. But then as you just said, it's like, okay, now I have to start working on all new stuff. It's like finding your voice again, your point of view going, okay, because I've seen comedians perform, whether it's in a theater or an arena or a club here in Colorado. And it's like you hear some of those jokes, but you hear some greatest hits and then you hear new things. So when you're performing this hour, getting ready to record it, are you putting in new stuff as well? Or are you just strictly staying with your hour and what's going to be on the album?
Oh no, I'm trying not to do anything that's on the album. So I think I have two repeat jokes and they're like my transition jokes. You know, they're the ones that make sense within the new jokes that I have. And one is still on my merch. So I kind of still have to tell that joke if I want to sell my merch. But I reconfigured it a little bit. So it is a little different. And then it relates to, you know, what I'm talking about now. So it's fine, but it's still like, even part of me is like, ugh, I got to get rid of those jokes. But
that's funny. It's kind of like, here's your sign or get her done kind of thing. It's like,
yeah, it's humiliating, but at the same time, I still enjoy telling it. So I think that's where it makes it okay, is that I still have fun and I play with it and I have a good time with it. So I can still justify selling the stickers.
That's funny. Yeah, well, I support that 100%. Like, even if you came to Colorado here to the Fort or to Comedy Works, I would still support a comedian because that's a big source of your income is selling the merchandise and, you know, money that goes to you, not necessarily to other people and then you later, which I think is something also fun I learned. I want to ask you, and I've heard this before, I don't know if it's the same for you, but when you put on an album like this, that's really a snapshot of your life up until that point, right? Where you've just experienced things. Is that the same for you, Caitlin, or is it a little bit different as far as like who you are as a comedian and as a person?
All my material is very personal. So it is like a, okay, this first album is Caitlin before she was engaged. You know, it was her meeting her future husband. It was her being a big old slut. It was her drinking. Like, I used to drink a ton and now I no longer drink. And so it's like this, it's adolescent Caitlin learning to grow up Caitlin. And then this next hour is angry Caitlin. And then the hour after that, who knows what it'll be, but it's all just kind of it is definitely a snapshot into my life and where I was at the time. And I think that's why I was ready to get rid of those jokes. It's like, I'm not her anymore. She's always a part of me, you know. I've learned a lot from her, but it's time to let her go, you know, and let go of that part of my life.
It's almost like healing in a way, right? Like, to let that part of yourself go, because I know there's this, you know, persona that's out there. Now, I don't know if you feel this way. It's like comedians are broken, sad clowns, and that, I don't think that's true necessarily, because like, you're a human being and you experience things. And it's like, that's the way your therapy really is. It's going to make it into a joke. Did you have to have a conversation with the person that you're married to when you're dating and in getting into the engagement that you might eventually wind up in my act at some point?
No, I'm dating a comedian. So it was assumed.
Oh,
so yeah, that conversation was the easiest in the world. It was like, can I tell this joke? He's like, yeah, but it needs a better punch. And then we would workshop it. And then.
So how is that being married to another comic? Because I've spoken to other comedians who have partners in entertainment or other comedians. Like, is it just a constant session at home running bits back and forth while you're washing dishes? No. Okay.
No, I would walk into the ocean. it's very fun because we're both silly. You know, we both have a good sense of humor. It's also relaxing because we know that, you know, we understand the mentality that goes behind being a comedian. So if you have to drop everything to go do a spot, that's fine. We also understand that being a clown is hard. I was with some guys who thought it was just all fun and games. And it's like, no, this is hard work. It's exhausting. Travel is exhausting. Performing for an hour is exhausting. And so it's nice to be able to come home after a long night of spots and just be able to sit in silence and not have someone be like, so tell me about everything. It's like, oh, my God.
Yeah, so it would be exhausting. I would imagine it's like there's this. It is hard work. Like, when I go somewhere and watch you perform, I see what appears to be flawless. It's just like one joke after another. People are laughing, people are whatever. But all of the years and hours, you know, experience that go into that, that's a big deal. So, like, where did it start for you as far as not like how did you become a comedian, but like, was there one or two cellular things that attracted you to it, or did you kind of always know this was something that you would be doing?
I had no idea this was something I would be doing. I didn't know it could be a job. I loved comedy, like in high school and in college, but I didn't realize that. I thought you had to go to school for it. I thought you had to be a writer or an actor. And so I didn't think it was something I could do because I was too afraid to, not even afraid, but just like, I didn't want to be an actress. And I didn't think I was a good enough writer to do it. I was in art school at the time, so I didn't realize that anyone could just go to an open mic. And then I went to an open mic and I was like, oh, anybody can do this. But I didn't even, I'd always enjoyed it and always liked it. And I always thought it was something I could be good at because I'm not shy. I'm not afraid of talking in front of people. I'm not afraid of making myself look like an ass. You know, I was always cracking jokes. I was the funny friend. But, you know, actually standing up and being the funny friend at 7 o'clock on a Saturday is different than just being a funny friend. So I wasn't sure if I could do it. It took me a while to get up the courage to actually try it. And once I did, I was like, oh, this shoe fits perfectly. So I off to the races.
Yeah. So you book your first late night spots. Take me back to that moment where you get those. Where are you at mentally, emotionally? Is that like a big high for you? Are you thinking, okay, this is it? Like the phone is going to ring off the hook? Or are you like, this is an opportunity? Joel Zimmerman has very serious thoughts about that moment, but I'm just asking you because I want to know what you think and what you thought when you first had that big break making it onto late night television.
Well, when I first did Colbert, it felt like justification because I started later. I started when I was 27. Or actually I started the day before I turned 27 because in my mind I had heard Bob Saget in a podcast, and he said that he started when he was 26. And I remember the host of the podcast was like, wow, that's pretty late. That's right on the cusp of being too late. And he was like, yeah, I just made it. And so in my 25-year-old brain, I was like, I have to start before I'm 27. And so I started the day before, like, talk about procrastination. But I remember very clearly feeling like, okay, so I made the right choice. Because I had quit art school. I didn't quit art school, but I quit being an artist. I gave up my studio in Bushwick. I quit my practice. I stopped taking pictures. I really dedicated myself to stand-up comedy, and I was a server, and I wasn't actively pursuing any of my other, what I went to college for. And so it was like, oh, and it happened 4 years in, which is relatively early. So it definitely felt like I was going in the right direction. I had a talent for this. It was like, it just felt like a heavy sigh of relief that I had put my eggs in the right basket. I had broken up with a boyfriend. I really had just dedicated my whole life to stand up. And so when Colbert was like, okay, here we go, I was like, oh, okay. I did it. I made the right choice. Because a lot of times I feel like in your 20s, you're just trying on different hats to see what fits. And I really, by that time, I think I was 31. And so it was like, oh, thank God this hat fits because I'm running out of time.
Yeah. I mean, mm-hmm. You've obviously had very measurable success. Where does the validation come from for you? Is validation important? Is it come from your peers as comedians, from when the audience laughs at your jokes, or when you book a spot at the Cellar and you're a regular, you've been passed? I'm interested to know, because I think that drives a lot of artists, maybe. Some people just don't care. I've had people tell me that. They're like, I'll just be honest with you, I don't care about validation. What's more important to me is this or that. Mm-hmm. What's important to you?
I think it's different things have been important at different times. After the pandemic, I got passed at the Cellar the day after they reopened. And that was a huge validation because the pandemic, we didn't know if stand-up was even coming back. Mm-mm. It was so terrifying, but I stuck with it. I stayed in New York. I was doing shows on rooftops and in backyards and parks. I was like screaming at dogs. Like I was doing anything to try and survive as a stand-up. And so that validation was like super important to me. And I remember being very nervous for my audition. But it ended up going fine. I got passed. And now I would say the validation from the audience and the industry is less important. It's my peers that is important. I want to create material that matters, that's smart, that's funny. And that, you know, when I go on stage, people aren't like, ugh, Caitlin, you know what I mean? So it's, I would say right now that's where I'm at in building. That's where my mentality is building this new hour. It's okay. I want to say things that matter this time. I don't want to just do the joke because it's the joke and it's people laugh. And therefore I'm like, okay, it's done. So I want to make sure it's true to my voice and what I have to say.
How far in was it for you before you really started feeling comfortable with your voice as a stand up? Like
never.
Never. And that's okay.
I'm still not comfortable. It's so hard. Finding your voice is so hard. And I got to say, I don't even know if I have it yet. I'm still working it out. They say it comes 10 years in and I am in year 10 and I am waiting for that aha moment for it's like, oh yeah, I know this is going to be funny. It hasn't happened yet. I still do a lot of trial and error and I still have a hard time focusing. I still do a lot of crowd work. it's hard. Like I've been told it's like this boom moment, like lightning striking. And I haven't had that yet. So if it has happened, I don't know about it. So
yes. Well, I mean, I feel like when I watch you perform, whether it's on your TikTok or wherever, and this doesn't mean much
my
coming
TikTok.
From,
oh boy.
Or wherever, you know, whether it's Instagram or YouTube, like I watch you mm-hmm. perform. I don't feel like I'm watching somebody else is my point in what I'm saying. Like, I feel like this is you pretty standard from when you started to now. You've opened up for some amazing people. Like, have any of those people ever given you some advice that has stuck out to you or was important to you? Or is it just an opportunity to maybe get in front of a different audience that you may or may not have access to now? Or maybe you do, I don't know.
Well, I've been very lucky that I've opened for a lot of kind people. Like Mateo Lane, Fortune Feimster, Maria Bamford, and Brian Regan, they're all genuinely nice people. And they treat everybody from the ushers to the ticket takers to their tour agent with the same amount of respect. And that is something that, you know, they don't say you should do this. It's something you see and you, I think, is extremely important. And I think it, especially, you know, with Maria Bamford and Brian Regan, it shows longevity. It's just it's an understanding of what it takes to put on a show and put on a good show and it leave with happy audience members. And so it's not really like advice given. It is just, you know, something you learn from watching.
Be kind, I think, is key, you know?
Yeah. And you see a lot of unkind people in this business and, you know, there's, you know, you wonder how long they're going to last because they have no friends, you know, no one wants to work with them. I think the biggest lesson that I learn just by watching is kindness and professionalism, showing up on time, showing up prepared, not showing up drunk, like showing up ready, taking it seriously as in, I am so lucky to do this job. I'm going to treat it with the amount of respect it deserves because we're incredibly lucky to, you know, make our money living our dream. Not everybody gets to do that. Most people don't get to do that. So it's something that I see the people that I open for that I see, they don't take it lightly. And so it's like, yeah, it's leading with gratefulness. Does that make sense? Am I making
sense? It does.
No,
100%. Okay. Like, yeah. Like I don't know. We've been very fortunate, present company included, to talk to some amazing people. And I love the people that you work with at Shark Party. I really do mean that because mm-hmm. the people that they provide to us, like it's just a constant overflow of amazing comedians, you know, all at different places and stations in their career. But I get it. Like when you say it out loud, like people pay to come see you mm-hmm. tell jokes for an hour. Like it sounds asinine. It's like, what is this about? But then like, we come because you bring like this level of joy, or maybe I've had a crappy night as a single parent or a married mm-hmm. person, whatever. And for an hour, I get to just like kind of cut loose a little bit and like, you know, and it shows that you're thankful for all those things, whether you've played at a bar or a laundromat. I don't know, you know, mm-hmm. like
I've done both.
During COVID. Did you try the Zoom shows at all during the pandemic?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. How was that for you?
Zoom, it is what you make it. It's not ideal, but it is convenient. It's tough, but you know, if there's people on there who want to be there, you just have to focus on the ones who are smiling and, you know, it's not great. It's not great for the performer, but it seems to be great for the audience. So you just kind of suck it up and do it. And I remember doing one of the first ones, I think a week into the pandemic, so it was in like, I forget who did it, but it was like an experimental thing.
Was it Ben Glebe or Steve Hofstetter, like their virtual comedy club, one of those guys maybe? Or
I've done that one a few times, yes. But they started that after this one guy. I forget, gosh, I'm kicking myself. It was literally like a week after lockdown. Like they shut down the clubs. And then a week later, they were like, we're trying this Zoom thing. What do you think? And we're like, what's Zoom? We have no idea.
I know. It's just become like a part of our culture. If I go back and listen to my catalog during 2020 to 2022, it's so funny to listen to some of like really big people, actors, comedians talk about like the world coming to an end, basically. And we're going to, I mean, Steve Hofstetter bought a church. He uses it now for other things, but like this idea of people building comedy clubs in their basements or doing drive-in theaters and Sam Morrell and all you guys doing rooftop shows and coming, it just shows the creativeness of your industry of like, we're going to figure this out because, you know, regardless of the agents or the people that are losing out on millions of dollars, like you have families to feed or yourself to feed at the time, whatever. Mm-hmm. Like I listened to your material from when you started to like your most recent stuff. And although I do see Caitlin, I also see like you changing as a person. One last question or two here, like looking back at your career, 10 years is a long time to be in this business. Like, do you have any regret, not regrets, but like moments where you go, man, you know, I wish I would have said yes to this or said no to that? Or is every single opportunity you've had just been a stepping stone to where you're now a very successful comedian where you're performing and touring regularly and you don't have to do a side hustle necessarily to make it work?
Yeah, I would say I don't try and look backwards. You know, I try not to dwell on the past. I'm grateful for it. I think I try and live my life being grateful for every opportunity I get than rather, dang, I wish I got that, you know? I feel very fortunate. So I don't want to, I've turned some stuff down. Don't get me wrong. I've turned some stuff down. And there are times when I was like, oh, I should have done a little more research on that. But I've learned from all of it. So I can't really sit here and be like, well, I've made a huge mistake. I'd be Amy Schumer if I had only done that one thing. No, I don't have any of that. I can't believe I still get to do this, because before this I was crawling on my hands and knees, scraping paint off of concrete floors. I was an art handler. I was building walls. I was sanding, like I was literally doing manual construction labor. And, so I go from, you know, doing that. And then also being a person who was drinking her life away, that, you know, when you come out of that black hole, you look back with nothing but gratefulness. Cause you can't dwell on the time you lost. You have to dwell on how you can make the next 10 years better. No regrets, just gratefulness and just so happy that this is my job. I still can't believe that I went to the gym at 1 o'clock on a Monday because I was like, oh, I have 2 shows tonight. I better get it in. You know, like that's crazy. That's insane. And the gym was empty because everybody was at a day job. Like that's mind blowing to me. So I'm just, I'm grateful. Very grateful.
Yeah. Awesome. Any plans to come to Colorado anytime soon? I know you've been here in the past, but I always like to ask.
Yeah.
Because I love to come out and support you guys when you make it out this way.
Yeah. Please come to the Comedy Fort. I'm going to be there May 31st and June 1st. One of my favorite clubs in the country.
Amazing.
It's so good. David Rodriguez really locked it in. That club is great. That community is great. I love it there and I'm going to be there. We're doing 4 shows so far. Last time we sold out most of them. So, and we added a show. So be on the lookout, buy your tickets now. And, because I think that show sells out regularly anyway, because he's really locked it in. But yeah, one of the best clubs in the country. Great staff, great comics, great community. I love
Albright and those guys are phenomenal. And I'm in Loveland here and they do these brewery shows regularly. like Adam Caton is performing this Wednesday at one of the bars here. I mean, just like, it's so cool. Like, I'm from California, so I'm used to the Bay Area scene. And when I got here,
that's where I'm from.
Yeah, yeah.
Shut your little mouth.
I lived in Vacaville, California for years.
Oh, I know Vacaville. I used to play soccer in Vacaville.
Yeah, so I've seen you at some of these places, like, you know, Punchline, Sack. I mean, those that was my go-to club. But here it's the Fort because, yeah, I lived in California for 10 years. I don't miss it. I love Colorado much better for obvious reasons. But yeah, Vacaville was my home forever. And we moved out here.
What a change. Vacaville is like a longer story,
but yeah, I can tell you off tape. I don't want to bore our listeners. They've heard it so many times. They're like, oh, he's going to talk about how he moved to Colorado.
Yeah.
But yeah, congratulations, Dirty Bird, March 8th on Blonde Medicine. Congratulations. And we'll see you in May at the Fort. Thank you so much, Caitlin. You're the best.
Thank you for having me. This was fun.
Absolutely.
Thanks for listening and being a part of today's conversation.
Thank you!
If you enjoyed today's episode, please consider sharing it with a friend. It's absolutely free.
Omega proportions.
The views and opinions of our guests do not necessarily reflect those of the host.
And remember, we care.